Welcome to another episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In, recorded on April the 3rd, 2024. I'm your host, Robert Swarthout, and I'm joined by my co-host, Andres Sindate. How's it going, Andres?
Hey, Robert. Good. I'm up in the mountains of Blue Ridge, Georgia, for spring break this week with a few families. So I decided I would just show our audience the live backdrop. It's awesome. Sunny and beautiful here in the mountains.
Yeah, you know, Atlanta's a little cooler today. It actually was warmer at 8 a.m. this morning than it's going to be at 5 p.m. today. So it's one of those weird days where we're headed for a little 2 or 3 days of cold. Probably our last little bit of cold for the spring.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, our first topic is a bit of closure. You know, we think. I'm sure there's an appeal coming because, you know, everything seems to appeal these days. But SBF was sentenced this last Thursday. You know, his case, he was found guilty on all charges and all and everything that he could be, at least that he was charged with and went to court over. He was sentenced to 25 years. On one hand, that's going to feel like a very long time to him because he's still in his 30s. But, you know, some people, and I would probably be included in that, probably think that wasn't enough. You know, the real question is justice served, even if he serves the full 25 years, which is probably highly unlikely because there'll be good behavior in there. And I think federal guidelines say that he has to serve at least 80% of that. So 20 years. So even more salt in the wound for the victims, in my opinion.
So. Yeah. No, I'm with you that I would have liked to have seen him get the upper end of the, I guess, the range. I was hearing, you know, potentially as many as 40 or 50 years. For the charges that he was, you know, for the things he was charged with, it could have certainly been much, much worse for him.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put these two individuals in the same camp, but, you know, for those who saw what happened to Michael Milken back in the 80s, you know, he was kind of the person who was synonymous with the leveraged loan market, the junk bond market, and has a lifetime ban from the Securities and Exchange Commission. And he, over the course of the last 30 years, has done a lot of really, really good things philanthropically for science, mm-hmm. research. And I think a lot of people may not even know about his background. And, you know, I always try to find the positive in things. And there's been so many people hurt by what happened with SBF. And again, we led off the show by saying, we don't know if this is the end of SBF. You just hope that, you know, those that were victims are able to get some recovery, if not full recovery of the dollars they invested. They certainly aren't getting to participate in the upside of crypto and Bitcoin here the last 6-12 months. But yeah, I bring up Milken because this doesn't have to be the very end for this guy, and we'll see what he decides to do. Kind of built his whole name on this effective altruism, and right. I guess we'll find out how effective and altruistic he really is at this point.
He may have trouble being giving going forward because he was also ordered to forfeit $11 billion.
Yeah,
you know, like if he has more than $11 billion or more than $1 billion at this point, obviously, the estate of FTX should be coming after that. But
yeah, for sure.
You know, my opinion is he should have gotten much higher number of years. He was potentially up for life, 110 years. So obviously more than life. And the judge was very strict, scolded him in court during this final ruling, even mentioned that he knew he lied on the stand, and then gave him what many people might call a cupcake sentence. So,
yeah. No. I struggled with one last point. I struggled with his lack of contrition until, you know, almost the very end. I mean, I think he did acknowledge, if I'm reading correctly, the news reports the day of sentencing. But right. But like you said, all the way up until the very end, really played this card of defense of, you know, I really didn't know. I was just sort of
too smart to know.
And yeah. I just don't buy that, you know. Right. So he needs to go away and be away for a long, long time.
Yeah. His mom wrote a letter to the court did not seem remorseful at all for him, and was basically saying, you know, look at all the good he was doing for the world. No, he wasn't doing any good. He was stealing. And any good that he appeared to be doing was other people's money he was giving away. So it's just, it seems to, that thread seems to run through the whole family that may be a little disconnected from what actually is reality there. So.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's move on. I know we've got a lot of other more impactful topics, if you will, about what's going on in crypto. So let's jump into point two.
Yeah. So this last week, I think it was on Friday, the Southern District, New York, there was a judge there that is handling the SEC and Coinbase case. The Coinbase had filed for a motion to dismiss early on in this, basically saying this is all crazy. Make this go away, effectively. The judge came back and ruled that most of it can go forward, but the judge did rule that the Coinbase wallet, which is different than Coinbase.com. So Coinbase wallet is something you might find in the App Store, in Google Play, or in the iOS app. It's a self-custody wallet for largely Ethereum. You can do Bitcoin and some other, but largely those two majors. Is not a broker. The SEC was alleging that the software wallet was a broker, which would be a big deal if they won that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that brings so much more underneath what the SEC would be their jurisdiction. So that was a bit of a sigh of relief. You know, the barrier to keep this case going was rather low for the SEC. The SEC made a lot of allegations in their response by this shouldn't be dismissed, and they didn't really have to prove the facts. There's many attorneys on crypto Twitter saying, well, now they actually have to prove these things that they say they're doing, and good luck with that. So it, you know, we are dealing with the SEC, and they are, you know, hard to deal with. So,
yeah, well, you know, a plug for next week on Tuesday,
yes,
the 9th of April, you and I are going to host a live stream with a former SEC enforcement attorney. Who is a partner at a leading law firm that does a lot of fund formation work, a lot of work in the crypto space. And we're hoping, I know, to be able to ask some of those questions of our guest, Ron Geffner. Mm-hmm. He served at the SEC as an attorney, you know, some years ago prior to this most recent enforcement strategy against digital assets and crypto. But nevertheless, I think being able to talk to folks that are on the front lines advising clients around the SEC's posture. Clearly, they're swinging a hammer, a big hammer, and trying to, whether it's bring down the industry or be relevant in the face of growing interest in this asset class, remains to be seen. But I know you made the point on our last check-in that, you know, short of a new administration, we may be in for more of these same tactics, depending on which way the election goes in November.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. So, you know, if you're a single issue voter over crypto, make sure you vote correctly.
All right. Well, let's talk about Bitcoin. 7 straight monthly green candles.
Yeah, this hasn't happened since 2012 for Bitcoin. This is, you know, there's a lot of positive news around Bitcoin these days, especially around the Bitcoin ETFs. But this is a big deal, like from a charting technical analysis perspective. You know, of the 7 months, 2 of them were largely flat, admittedly, barely eked out much of a gain, but, you know, positive nonetheless. And if you look at the chart leading up to that, you know, 2023, you know, Bitcoin slowly just rose throughout the year, but starting in September, you had a smaller month than October, November, where in December were decent sized jump ups. You know, January was kind of cool off while we were waiting for the ETF to launch largely. And then February, oh my gosh, what a big candle. So it's kind of up and to the right now with, you know, the last month prices largely being stable, or stable for crypto, I should say. It's you know, it's cool to kind of see. And just, you know, we're coming up in the halving later this month. So we're early in the cycle. The pullback that we've had over the last 3 or 4 days, probably 5 days at this point, has been kind of expected. We have a pullback right before the halving, and then it seems to, you know, in at least past cycles, want to take off from there and go upwards. So
let me ask you a question before we move to Kathy Wood's Bitcoin call that came out last week. As somebody who's following technical and charting, and also is doing a lot of fundamental work on the underlying alternative tokens that are out there, when you look at the when you look at the technical information like a chart and looking back at patterns, what are some of the things that like everyday investors can draw from your experience? If you were not giving them advice, but what should they be looking at beyond just the price action with respect to starting to just better understand the space? Like what have been your observations?
Yeah, I would say this is kind of not an answer to your question, but I think it's important to mention, you know, a lot of times people will look at crypto and like, they're like, oh, Bitcoin is at, you know, 50 or 65,000 and change today. You know, oh my gosh, Ethereum is at whatever. Oh, I found this other token that is less than a penny. If it only went up to a tenth of a penny, you know, you have to, people very easily lose sight of what is the float, how many tokens are outstanding of each individual one. Bitcoin is rather small at 21 million ever. Then you have, you know, XRP is an example of it, 100 billion. Well, there's a very big magnitude difference. If you were to kind of, I guess, right size these things, it would be a little bit easier to compare, but I don't think that's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Back to your question, I would say the average person is not going to get into technical analysis. You're going to be a bit of a nerd if you're doing that, which is fine. You're just going to be in it a lot more than I think the average person might be.
Yeah.
You know, I study not tons of technical stuff, but I use the technical stuff to inform what we may be at in a cycle, whether that's a bear or a bull market cycle. Crypto follows, I wouldn't say the same playbook every time, but pretty close to it. There's patterns in it. And I think part of it's reinforced because those patterns are coded into trading bots that go out there to trade what the past cycles have done. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy at some level. And, you know, there's slight variations. And this time with the ETF and the inflows from that, I think that is potentially adding some stress to those models in ways that, you know, may not be, have been predicted.
Yeah. And when you say trading bots, you're referring to like algorithmic trading bots, computer driven, yes, that are out executing trades based on computer programs and other, whether it's human influenced on the front end, but these are trades that are happening that are moving the price around in these different tokens.
Yeah, because it's not as simple as like, oh my gosh, the price of Apple is this, right? I mean, that's pretty much a known thing. Bitcoin or whatever token you care about in crypto could be on 200 different exchanges around the world.
Right.
So there could be arbitrage just between that one token, depending on where you're buying and selling it at. So you have that mixture and the, you know, your whatever you can trade sometimes from one crypto into Bitcoin or one crypto into Ethereum versus going back to a dollar or euro or whatever it may be. So there's all these crazy amounts of trading pairs. In some systems, you'll even see where they'll trade from one pair into another pair as part of a trade to kind of they find the, I guess, I don't know if you consider double arbitrage there, but you kind of find that hop that happens. So it's not something that I actively do. I've done a little bit of reading on it, more so from my computer science side of my brain, curious about it than anything else. So.
Yeah. Yeah. They're safe to say, given the 24/7 nature and all the exchanges in the global aspect and how so many participants in the market, retail to institutional, can participate, we are many, many, many cycles away from, I would say, regulation at least, and a similar market structure that you have to like the S&P 500 stocks.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk about Cathie Wood and this uber bullish call that she came out with. First of all, who's Cathie Wood? Maybe a little bit of context before we talk about the $3.8 million Bitcoin call she made.
Yeah, she's aggressive. So Cathie is famous from her, I guess, more traditional equity style investing that she does. She has some funds, ARK investments. There's different ARK ETFs that you can buy into. And she kind of, you know, became famous, I guess you might call it that, over the last 10 years, but certainly during COVID with her, some of her technology plays that she did that made her a talking head on CNBC, it seems. So, you know, she's obviously a smart lady. And in some sense, from a crypto perspective, she's rather forward thinking, even outside of her crazy Bitcoin price. I say crazy because I would love to know what context and years that she's talking about this thing in. Like, is this a 10-year price or is this a 3-year price? you know, she had the highest price I had ever seen predicted for it by anyone of, I guess, recognition at a million. And then for whatever reason, last week, she decided that she needed to, I guess, one up herself. I don't quite understand it, to go to 3.8 million, which is a huge multiple from the 65,000 that we're at today. So,
yeah. So clearly, you know, without knowing a lot of the details, I'd say our take, well, I should say my take is this is a multi-year call. It's a decade long call. You know, we both talk to a lot of people in the market each week between these sessions, these updates. And one thing that I asked an institutional crypto manager last week was, you know, talk about utility and value of Bitcoin. And, you know, the sales professional that I was talking to was, I don't think was probably as articulate as maybe the chief investment officer, who's probably fielding that question daily from institutional clients. But when you go back and you sort of do the research, what you see is a lot of folks that are pro Bitcoin and the Bitcoin ETFs will talk about, you know, folks like Jamie Dimon and people maybe from more of the traditional valuation camp don't understand about Bitcoin is it's like they'll draw the comparison to fine art or rare cars or collectibles, that there clearly is a value of a Mona Lisa painting or a Monet or, you know, sure, something. What is that value? Well, it's what somebody would pay for it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that in one sense, when you talk about valuation and is the 3.8 conservative, aggressive, like it's very difficult to pin down these folks,
right?
And really get anything behind these models and these calls, unlike a traditional stock. And so you sort of have to suspend belief a little bit if you're going to try to compare it to, mm-hmm, you know, what's going on in the traditional asset classes. What's your take, like when you see these calls?
They seem very sensationalized. You know, like I wish that the person interviewing would ask more questions, more thoughtful questions, like, you know, what kind of time frame? And, you know, they're obviously going to try to squirm around that answer because they don't want to be held to something. I get that. But at the same time, they're also saying a number that needs to be grounded in something, in my opinion.
They also sponsor an ETF that owns.
Right. Yes.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, a little bit talking their own book in a way, which, you know, that's Wall Street, right? These are all folks, mm-hmm, making money. Let's be honest here and direct. But yeah, I mean, a $3.8 million call, I guess this kind of goes back to the reason we did the show though. I mean, is that we wanted to talk about the headlines and dig into them and see if there's substance and see if, yeah, you know, there's something there. We have not found that yet. We haven't found that report, but if we do find it, we'll put it out there.
Absolutely. You know, yeah, when she had her $1 million call, that was like, oh, that's a round number. She's just kind of like picking a big number. Now it's like 3.8, like oddly, like that seems like there's some thought behind it. Well, let's see the thought, Kathy.
Yeah. So we'll dig around for additional support behind that. Perhaps there is a research piece or something that's come out, but nevertheless, a talking head, a big figure in the space that does capture a lot of people's attention on CNBC and newspapers and headlines. You know, she's not moving the market, but when somebody like her or somebody, you know, one of these other 10 or 20 notable figures, mm-hmm, from traditional finance speaks, there's a lot of people that do pick their head up, and certainly the headline. So this last two, Robert, that we've got here, I think speak to the, you know, increased adoption, call it trend, that we've talked about the last couple of weeks on these weekly check-ins. So you pulled a couple of headlines. Let's start with the PNC headline around them adding BITB.
Yeah, I mean, and you're right. It really, these last two can be combined into one bullet point, but with PNC being slightly different in that they're only going to be offering the Bitwise, at least from everything that I've read, they're only going to be offering the Bitwise BITB Bitcoin ETF to their clients via their wealth management platform.
And why does PNC matter? Like what, I don't, you know, some people know this institution, some people know this bank, but
yeah, I mean, they're a top 10 US bank. I mean, like they're, I don't know exactly what their wealth management number is on assets under management, but it's probably $1 trillion.
Yeah, at least really one of the 10 largest banks in the country,
yeah,
regulated, right?
Right. And a lot of reach. I mean, they're a lot, and not just regional, right? I mean, they're a big, sure. big bank. So
yeah, present in the Southeast where we're based out of in Atlanta, mm-hmm. you know, obviously yeah. the East Coast. So a top 10 institution basically saying, okay, we're going to approve this product, is newsworthy because we've been talking about right now, a lot of the adoption of, you know, crypto, a lot of it is, you know, there's probably institutions trading it. We think, you know, mm-hmm. it's hard to know who owns these ETFs. Just it's right. different the way these instruments are set up. But nevertheless, it's clearly retail dollars. There's probably institutional dollars where I think there's potentially a lot of flows. And I'd like to hear your take mm-hmm. is within the wealth management, private wealth channel. Yeah. And when those dollars start to move, we're talking trillions and trillions of retirement assets that could potentially come into this space.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned something there about institutional investments. I believe that we're about to start potentially seeing some of that disclosed, right? 13Fs are about to come out if there's any, I guess, publicly traded institutions. Or I think that's how that works. Admittedly, I don't know for certain.
Yeah, they have a certain amount of holdings they've got to disclose. Yeah,
on a quarterly basis, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe we'll start seeing that in the next couple of weeks on some of those. But, you know, to me right now, all the interest or the majority of the interest outside of, say, hedge funds investing in these ETFs would have been me calling my broker saying, or my financial advisor saying, please buy this. Like there's no outbound sales happening. And I think when you see PNC turning it on and our last bullet point there with Morgan Stanley and UBS, you know, their sales team or their brokers are allowed to basically make a phone call and say, hey, I think you should do this. I think we should do a 1% allocation or whatever it may be. That's a lot of dollars. I mean, just, you know, Morgan Stanley alone, I think is $1.5 trillion in client assets, and UBS is at 3.5. I mean, that's 5 trillion plus whatever PNC is, call it another trillion. It's a lot, even if it's 1%. And it takes right. 2 or 3 years. That is a huge amount of inflows. So
yeah, I mean, you know, I think we talked about this in a prior call, and all these are recorded. For those that are not able to listen live on our live streams every Wednesday at 1:30 Eastern time, the good thing is these are recorded. But we did talk about, you know, BlackRock and Fidelity, the two clear leaders out of the gate in terms of flows into mm-hmm. their ETF products. But nevertheless, Bitwise has been on, they've been on the trail, if you will. They've been out in the market for a number of years, trying to establish their name. Mm-hmm. They do have a following. They do have inflows into their product, and they don't just have ETFs. They have a series of different offerings, mm-hmm. private funds, and other style vehicles. So there is more and more competition that's going to come to the space. And, mm-hmm. you know, one thing about Morgan Stanley and UBS is, you know, they are just two of a number of the big wirehouses that likely, you know, are going to move in similar fashion around this, because, you know, brokers and advisors at these platforms know, you know, they know their buddies at the other shops in town, and they know mm-hmm. that, you know, that they kind of have a sense for what everybody else is doing. And so it's hard to imagine a scenario where three of the four offer it and one doesn't, right? Or two right. offer it and two don't. So I think we'll see over the course of the next quarter or two, as these firms conduct more diligence, right? Mm-hmm. They have to make sure they're meeting fiduciary obligations. They're going to have to make sure they're meeting suitability obligations. But to your point, like when you switch from taking the call mm-hmm. to being able to go make the call and say, hey, we're going to adjust the model, and the asset allocation is now going to include a 1-3%, whatever it is, we don't know. Right. We're speculating, right. but you know, it could be 1%, it could be 2%. Like that, mm-hmm. that's meaningful dollars when you have a $10 million family, or, you know, absolutely. Even a $2 million family, right?
Yeah.
So a lot to come here on this. I'm going to ask you for an analysis point though on these last two, as you think about, you know, even though I know you're not long Bitcoin, not that you're short, you just don't own it.
Right.
It's something you still follow, right? Yes. So what is your take as you look at these products, the inflows, you know, do you still think that the shine is on, if you will, and people are still, you know, going to want to adopt Bitcoin exposure generally? Or do you think that, you know, the hype is going to start to wear off over the next few quarters? Like, what's your sort of view?
I think that it's, you know, maybe use a different analogy here of it's currently an aluminum piece. It's a piece of aluminum, so it's kind of shiny. I think as the price appreciates, we go through a full bull market cycle, it's going to become a piece of chrome. Everybody's going to see how shiny it is. And then, you know, eventually when crypto rolls over and goes into a bear market, it becomes a little dull. I think that's going to be, you're going to really be tested with the holders at that point. Typically the investors, I think in traditional markets are more long-term focused than crypto investors are generally. But like, how does that mix when you bringing those two worlds together? They have been separate worlds in the past. And, you know, it'll be fascinating to watch play out. I can't imagine it exasperates a crypto bear market going down 80-90%. I can't imagine we go more than that. That would seem crazy to me. But does it kind of soften the blow a little bit because you have a little bit more people holding than you might otherwise possibly?
Mm-hmm.
So,
and the alternative, I guess, to a scenario where we have not just Bitcoin ETFs, but an alternative where in the next year or two we have multiple ETFs with multiple underlying tokens, or we have ETFs that have, you know, four or five different underlying tokens. I mean, there's going to be probably more product proliferation.
Right.
But there are also a lot of investors that just have not been through a full cycle, clearly
100%
with ETF exposure now,
yeah,
just being recent.
You know, and it's kind of a little bit off script here, but oddly ties in. So my wife and I have a donor advice fund that we do some giving out of. And I ran across a new donor advice fund company that allows you to have your portfolio or your account that's within that DAF with them invested in crypto. It could be a mixture of equities with crypto, or you can even go super risky where it's only Bitcoin or only Ethereum. They have 15 different portfolios. And I think four or five of them have some crypto in it in some fashion. So this is kind of fascinating to kind of see where it's popping up. You know, and if you don't necessarily need those funds to give for the next couple of years, it's an interesting possibility of maybe it'll like grow something that has a little bit more giving power down the road.
We have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to maybe get your take on the crypto news cycle. If we step back from these particular headlines, and you know, it seems like crypto news can come, and it is either like Bitcoin and talking about inflows and talking about one of the big talking heads making a call on Bitcoin, or it's like very technical, mm-hmm. and it can get into different projects and who's building what, who's raised what kind of money. The question is around the inflows of dollars into the space. Do you sense that it's still very much a FOMO driven, like headline driven cycle? Or do you think that people are starting to do a little bit more digging and trying to understand commercial utility, trying to understand like how these tokens are used, how's Bitcoin practically going to be used, etc.?
Yes, kind of in both sense, but I think that the FOMO is so much greater in size than any sort of real utility right now. There's certainly projects trying to have utility, but they don't have enough volume to really outweigh the clickbait nature of current crypto being so FOMO driven.
Yeah. So, but I think as more investors come into the space, wouldn't it be logical to think that they're going to ask more questions, they're going to want more evidence, research, support, etc. It's just going to, you know, continue to be a topic that people are going to want answers about.
I mean, obviously I'm biased when I say this, but yes, I believe that's going to happen. I hope that's going to happen. I, you know, all the things there. I also would say that at the end of the day, this is a long game, right? I mean, these cycles come and go in crypto, roughly 3-ish, 4 years, something like that. And right now we're playing the same game we've played the other three times the cycles happened. You just have to understand what game you're playing if you want to ride the wave, or you can ride it all the way through and go up and down and just be ready to stomach, you know, being potentially having some crazy gains in your portfolio. And then, you know, 3 months later, you could be down pretty dramatically, or over the course of a year from a top, it can be 80-90% a lot of times down. So,
Well, as always, there's a lot to break down each week. Like I said, we'll be live next Tuesday, Robert and I, on my live stream, ATL Alts. Robert's going to be a guest along with Ron Geffner, who's a partner at Satis. And we're going to talk about crypto. So it's going to be a great opportunity for those of you that want to learn more about what's happening on the enforcement front, what's happening in terms of jurisdictional choices you have if you're setting up a fund, and other important crypto related news and matters that impact a lot of the asset managers and to a large extent the investors that they're going to seek, you know, to raise capital from. So hope you can join us next Tuesday at 2 o'clock Eastern.
I'm looking forward to it, and thanks everybody for joining us.
Thanks, Robert. Good to see you again.
See ya.